Flint, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, Kevin Flint, assistant city, Omaha City Prosecutor on behalf of the state, the appellant in this case. We are here today on exception proceedings asking this court to review a decision from the District Court of Douglas County that reversed the county court conviction based upon the district court's review of a suppression motion that was overruled by the county court and then ultimately appealed to the district court after conviction by the defendant, in this case, Mr. Falcon. The issue in the case was whether or not the officer had probable cause to stop the vehicle in question that Mr. Falcon was driving on the day of the offense that ultimately led to his investigation and prosecution for driving under the influence of alcohol.
So the case, remind me again, the case got to the district court as a defendant appeal?
Correct. And the county court ultimately, we believe, ruled properly that there was probable cause to stop the vehicle in question because the defendant was in violation of 66225 because he was operating a motor vehicle with auxiliary lights on. And if you read the statute, the defendant is required to turn those lights off if he's approaching a vehicle within 200 feet because it refers back to the statute regarding the use of bright headlights.
If the headlights need to be dimmed, then the fog lights should be off.
Right, the auxiliary lights.
If you read those together, is that how they all fit?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think the reason for that is that, you know, you don't obviously the concern is the amount of light on either approaching the vehicle or following vehicles. And if you look at the testimony from Officer Soltis in this case, he indicated that what he noticed initially was his vehicle had been approaching him very closely, and that the interior of his car was illuminated, and he felt that there was excessive light and glare coming from the car behind him.
So did the officer have some misunderstanding about the law, or what is the?
Well, that's ultimately he did not understand the statute correctly because he believed that what the main issue was. He believed that they were not allowed to be on at all in these circumstances.
So is that a distinction that makes a difference?
I don't think it does because probable cause is judged on an objective standard. The question is whether an objective reasonable officer would have facts that would lead him to believe that a violation of the statute had occurred. And while he was correct that a violation of the statute occurred, he was just incorrect in how that violation, why that was actually a violation of the statute. And so that's why I think the district court is incorrect when it rules ultimately that because he's wrong about the application, that somehow negates his probable cause to ultimately, after the court rules on that. And as this court has noted, and the United States Supreme Court has noted, that officers out in the street are not required to be legal scholars. And I know we spend time as lawyers and judges ultimately reviewing these statutes and determining what they mean. Obviously, probable cause and reasonable suspicion is judged on a common sense, not a legalese type standard. So I think that's why ultimately the district court was incorrect in concluding that because he didn't get the right subsection of the statute, even though the district court did conclude, as the county court did, that there was indeed a violation of the law. It should not negate probable cause, and ultimately the conviction should not have been reversed because of that.
Counsel, if your argument has merit, what can we do?
We are asking this court to review it's a line of cases, I guess, most recently discussed in the Kleckner case. And that distinction ultimately is determined by this court's interpretation of 29-23-16 and what legally placed in jeopardy means. And I would submit to this court that I know this court has continued to be divided on this issue over the years, and it's our position that this court should overrule the line of cases. I believe it started in the Vasquez case and go back to the original understanding of what legally placed in jeopardy has meant.
And if you and go sorry, back, and go back to what?
Go back to what this court had previously ruled or that legally placed in jeopardy meant. Those cases are Nice and Shull and Wren, and those cases...
And what did we do before Shull?
The distinction was if the defendant was placed in double jeopardy, that legally placed in jeopardy didn't mean any more than being placed in double jeopardy.
So can you give? I'm sorry. So can you give me the case before Shull? What were we doing before Shull is what I'm trying to ascertain.
Okay, I'm not sure the exact sequence, but I think if you go back to Nice and Wren.
That's an answer to a different question.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure that this court had previously ruled anything different than that legally placed in jeopardy was consistent with constitutional double jeopardy, and in that line of cases, this the court concluded specifically there was nothing indicated in the language of those statutes in question, the legislative history, and normal understandings of double jeopardy to suggest that phrase meant anything different.
Well, you're looking at the statutory language in 2316 when the defendant in the trial court has been placed legally in jeopardy.
Correct.
So is that looking back? What happened? Double jeopardy. If the defendant, looking back, had been in jeopardy, here's what you can or cannot do under this statute?
I think the indication would be consistent with what the United States Supreme Court has ruled in cases in similar situations. The court has the ability to review issues involving sentencings and things that don't implicate double jeopardy.
Going forward. Don't do anything in this case going forward which would amount to double jeopardy. But I'm looking at this statutory language and saying, if this defendant historically had been placed in jeopardy, here's the options available to the appellate court.
Well, I think...
Is that the language of the statute? The defendant in the trial court has been placed legally in jeopardy.
That's the language in the statute, but what I disagree with and what other members of this court has disagreed with is the meaning of that. Because ultimately the question is, if the defendant was found not guilty, he's barred by the double jeopardy clause of being retried for that.
That's the easy case.
But the interpretation otherwise can produce absurd results.
What is the effect of the appellate courts reversing the conviction and vacating the sentence and the judgment? Has the defendant then been exposed to a double jeopardy claim such that another appellate court cannot come back and reverse that?
Well, that's what this court has to answer, and I would submit that's the absurd result you don't want to reach, because then ultimately has been pointed out before that the district court is ultimately the last word in the case, what's interesting that is.
So what you're saying is, under those circumstances, the appellate court that's higher than the district court cannot do anything with regard to the conviction.
Other than
an error proceeding.
Correct.
Well, the error proceeding is a jurisdictional statute, because ordinarily the state can't come up.
Correct.
So the legislature writes a statute and says the county attorney or the city prosecutor later can come up once or twice to the county, to district, or district to the appellate courts, right?
Correct.
And in granting that jurisdictional opportunity, there's a limited number of remedies available to the appellate court. Is that a roughly a fair statement? And they write the statute, because the legislature wrote this statute, and it didn't say, and the appellate courts should not put the defendant in the future in double jeopardy. Because that's what we do for a living, follow the Constitution to the best of our ability. It said something different. It said if this defendant, looking back, had been placed in jeopardy.
I understand the language of the statute. My suggestion is that it ultimately will reach an absurd result, because it will depend then which judge got it wrong. If the county court had gotten the issue wrong, and the state was allowed to appeal that to the district court,
right,
then that defendant would ultimately be convicted.
How about a reading of the statute like this, that in this case the district court was sitting as an appellate court, and the defendant was not placed in jeopardy at the district court? That was just a reviewing court.
Well, I understand.
In which case you would avoid the absurd result, because all the district court was doing was doing its appellate thing, which we could look at and tamper with, so to speak.
Doesn't this case discuss future cases that might have the same facts and deal with the same issue, such that if you're convicted in the county court and the district court reverses, you can take error to the appellate court, but that doesn't affect the defendant?
And I understand.
There's nothing absurd about that.
Well, what's absurd, I think, is the situation based upon the fact that if the county court had been the one issuing the wrong ruling, the state is allowed to appeal that. And it goes back down, and that conviction winds up standing.
Well, now, if he's acquitted in the county court, it's over.
True.
And if he's convicted and the state takes an appeal to, or the state's not taking the appeal if he's convicted, it's the defendant taking the appeal to the district court, and then the district court acquits him, then the rest of your review is simply for an error proceeding to describe what was wrong with the procedure done by the district court. Isn't that what it is?
Well, I respectfully suggest that I don't believe that that's what the legislature meant when it wrote.
You don't think that if the district court finds him not guilty?
Well, the district court doesn't find him not guilty.
It just reverses the conviction.
Right. It's an intermediate appellate court that reviews for relief.
But this is the circumstance of the district court sitting as an appellate court. It didn't get to the district court under 19, by which the state could go to the district court. So the district court sitting is an appellate court. So getting back to my third way, perhaps the defendant was not in jeopardy at the district court.
Well, I don't think the district court put the defendant in jeopardy. But like I said, I don't think he was, you know, I don't believe he was subject to double jeopardy, which I believe is the proper meaning of legally placed in jeopardy under that statute.
So the first issue is whether or not the defendant has been acquitted by the lower court. If that takes place, this is done as far as involvement of the defendant. You can seek a review of the ruling.
True, we can seek a review.
But what you're arguing is that since he was convicted in the county court, he's not placed in jeopardy until there is a final ruling by the last court of appeal.
Correct, and I think that's consistent. If it started as a felony case, it was a district court ruling that was ultimately appealed to the Court of Appeals, there could be a petition of further review to this court. And it would seem a strange result to say that.
And it doesn't become an error proceeding that doesn't affect the defendant. It can affect the defendant ultimately. Final Court of Appeal determines whether the defendant should be convicted or not.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Paragus, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Judges, members of the court counsel. Counsel stated that officers enforcing the laws on the streets and highways of the state of Nebraska are not legal scholars, but the basic tenet to uniform and a reasonable enforcement of our laws is that the officers at least have a rudimentary understanding of the laws and are able to interpret those laws to apply them to the factual situations that they encounter. In this particular case, Officer Soltis was clear that he pulled the defendant over simply because he believed that at no time can you have auxiliary lights on your vehicle unless the weather is unless there is inclement weather. Well, we get into an analysis of whether or not the officer, the statute that the officer was interpreting was counterintuitive or confusing. If you read the statute in this case, I submit to you, it's not counterintuitive, it's not confusing, and it certainly in no way talks about inclement weather. So I don't know how you could ever say
Officer Soltis was confused about the law. He was just clearly
flat out mistaken. Well, Mr. Slip suggests that we have to look at this from a reasonably objective standpoint. So does the officer's confusion or his subjective understanding here have anything to do with this?
I believe that it does. And the reason I believe that it does is that in this particular set of facts, he pulled the defendant over for a law that didn't exist, for a violation of a law that did not exist. And more importantly, Judge, at the trial court level, it was never established that Mr. Tolkien violated any other of the statutes. There were some ancillary facts that were presented that Officer Soltis saw the defendant approaching with bright lights from behind and exceptionally bright lights on the auxiliary lights, and I believe he testified at a high rate of speed. But they did not go on and prove that that high rate of speed was in excess of the speed limit. They did not go on and prove that the bright lights were of the nature that they needed to be dim.
But the state has narrowed its focus before us to a violation which it believes is established by the facts to which the officer testified.
Right.
Right? That,
yes, ma'am.
That the defendant was within, is this right, within 200 feet of the officer's car and under a circumstance which required the headlights to be dimmed and as a consequence the fog lights to be turned off. That I believe is what they're saying, and those are... Are any of those disputed facts?
Yes, I disagree with the second prong of, or the second fact that you stated. They did establish that Mr. Tolkien's vehicle was within 200 feet.
So I can check that off. There's no dispute on that.
Well, there is a dispute because they didn't testify that he was within 200 feet at the range which was contemplated by the statute.
I'm sorry, can you explain that?
Well, certainly. They alluded to a fact that Mr. Tolkien's vehicle was within 200 feet of the cruiser.
Right.
And was approaching from the rear. But they didn't say where from the rear was he on. Was he directly behind? Was he over on this road? Was he over on that road?
And why is that relevant under the 200 feet statute?
Because now what you have is we're trying to enforce a case where the officer was mistaken by the law. Now we're going to have an appellate court come in and say, oh, well, we weren't there, but based on a couple of ancillary facts that were proven, we're going to say that a crime and a violation was committed, even though we weren't there. If the state would then have gone on and tried to prove that there was another violation, which they did not at this level, at the trial court level, then there could have been cross-examination, and then it could have been clearly established that, in fact, there was a violation of another statute. Again, they talked about speeding, they talked about lights, but they never went on and proved beyond a reasonable doubt that that there was a violation of any other statute, and Officer Soltis then went on and clearly said, when pressed, the sole reason for your stop was that you believed that the defendant should not have his lights on unless there was inclement weather, and the answer to that question was yes.
Did the county court make findings on the motion?
I don't believe so. They just overruled the motion.
What is the effect of having a conviction in the county court and then a reversal in the district court and then an appeal from the district court to an appellate court? What's the defendant's implication in the case?
Well, I believe in the basic tenet that once in jeopardy, always in jeopardy. And so now, when the bench trial was...
Were convicted in the county court, and then...
Correct.
The next appeal reversed the conviction.
Correct.
And then the state takes a proceeding pursuant to 25-2315.01.
Yes.
What remedy is available to the state under that proceeding?
Well, I believe the remedy available is just the future cases. And
so you can't reinstate the conviction against the defendant?
No. That would result,
wasn't that your best argument here?
Yes, that would result in double jeopardy, and I think in an ex post facto.
I mean, you don't need to argue about where the stop was right or wrong in this particular proceeding. You don't really care. Your conviction has been set aside, and a subsequent determination by this court, under your theory, won't affect the rights of the defendant. He's been acquitted.
Well, under the application of the statute and the decisions of this court, I think you're correct.
So that's your best argument, isn't it?
Well, I think, respectfully, I think what you're suggesting is that I don't have a dog in this fight.
Nobody's disputing that fact, that the appellate court, the district court reversed the conviction.
No one's disputing that.
The state took an error proceeding.
Yes, sir.
And the state's going to get its information on whether or not the district court was right or wrong, but that doesn't affect you.
No, I don't believe that it does, not when you properly apply 29-2316. I think applying that and the court's rulings in this case clearly indicate that my client is not affected by the ruling in this proceeding, but it does provide direction for future fact scenarios of a similar pattern.
Counsel, let's not lose sight of what your client was convicted of. He was convicted of DUI. He wasn't convicted of driving within 200 feet of the vehicle. The basis of the district court's reversal was not that your client was not guilty of DUI. It was a legal conclusion that there was no basis for the stop. So the jeopardy that was attached to the conviction was not affected at all by what the district court concluded as a matter of law, unless we adhere to the line of cases that Mr. Slimp wants us to repudiate.
Well, the flaw in that analysis is that there was then a bench trial that was had, and at that bench trial, there had to be a finding. The motion to suppress was renewed before the bench trial, and then the bench trial was had, and so there had to be an analysis of the probable cause as providing the basis for the DUI arrest in the decision of the court, and therefore he was placed in jeopardy.
But
there
it's
was a
not,
trial. Had.
It's not one of the elements of the crime of which your client was convicted.
I agree.
It's simply a Fourth Amendment issue as a matter of law.
I agree.
Okay. So the question that you hear us ratcheting up and down the bench about is whether or not the Kleckner and preceding cases were good or bad law, and what you're arguing really doesn't go to that.
Right.
Okay.
Well, sure. I'll concede that.
All right.
I would just respectfully ask this court to follow its previous rulings and apply 29-2316 in the manner in which it was intended.
You like that because it helps your client?
Absolutely.
I don't blame you. Thank you.
If I have no further questions, I will just ask the court to, number one, uphold the ruling of the district court, and then number two, stay with the line of cases and the statutes in regard to the remedy in this case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Our